Second Court of Appeals. We have several cases on our docket this afternoon, but you all are the only ones set for oral submission. And I understand you have spoken to our clerk and announced the time you would like to argue. So with that, our clerk will call the case and we will get started.
The court will now call Emerson Company, DBA, Insight, and Emerson Department of Technologies Incorporated versus Clarence Johnson and the United States Liability Insurance Company. May please support. Mr. David Gunn will argue for the appellant. Mr. Jeffrey Revolution will argue for the appellant.
May it please the court and good afternoon. I'm David Gunn, and I am delighted to be here with you today arguing with my friend Jeff Levenger, because this is the kind of case for which I think law school, it's the highest service we can do, and we are going to try to give you the best arguments we can give you so you can make a decision. I'm very pleased with the way the case is briefed out, and I would like to make 3 points today in the time that you've given me. The 3 points are about the dangers. Number one, already known. Number two, obvious. And number three, not unreasonable. That is to say, the first 2 points go to the warnings claims. The third point about unreasonably dangerous goes to the design claim. If time allows, I want to touch briefly on the fire and the lack of explanation for the fire, although it's not necessary for you to reach that. So let's start with point one, already known. I take it as common ground, unless they disabuse me later. I take it as common ground that the plaintiffs are correct, the plaintiffs' papers are correct when they say, Johnson told his nephew Antonio of the dangers of terminal venting, unquote, and quote, Johnson took the danger of terminal venting seriously. If that is true, I think it should, we can all agree, the plaintiff knew of the danger, and that in fact is true. It is not disputed in the record. The two parties to the conversation, the plaintiff and Antonio Morris, agreed on this point. There's no one to contradict it. It is not in conflict. Now, what's the consequence if the plaintiff knew of the dangers? I want to give you a case that I didn't give you, although I think it's self-evident that should cut off causation. And it's your decision from 10 years ago in Ethicon against Meyer, which is 249 3rd. 513. And I'll just read one line from that opinion that will tell us what we all know intuitively. When a product's user is aware of the possible risks involved with a product's use but decides to use it anyway, the inadequacy of the product's warning is not, as a matter of law, a producing cause of an injury resulting from such use. It's Justice Gardner's opinion. There are many other cases that follow this principle. So if we are right about the record, and if they were right in what they said in their JNOV response about the record, that should be the end of the warnings claim. There is a parallel path that you could take on causation. I don't want you to miss it. I don't want to dwell on it, but I'll mention a decision from the Supreme Court in the wave of cases that we've gotten in the last few weeks. And as I caught up on those, the April 28th decision in Rogers against Zanetti caught my eye, simply because it deals with the problem of the road not taken, the problem of, well, what if? Rogers is a legal malpractice case, and the client said, my lawyer didn't tell me about the $450,000 settlement offer. Supreme Court said, well, what would have happened then if you had been told? And the plaintiff didn't really say. The plaintiff said, well, I would have gone to mediation and negotiated, but didn't say, I would have taken the offer. We have a comparable situation here, because I looked for evidence where Mr. Johnson said, if I had known, here's what I would have done. And the most I could find was the statement we gave you where he said, well, I would let it cool off and give it more consideration than I gave it. I don't think that shows where the road not taken actually leads. If the terminal is like a champagne cork on the lip of the bottle about to come out when it's jiggled, I think we need a little more evidence to tell us, would it not have come out on that August day here under the Texas sun? I don't think we know. You don't need to go that way, but I don't want you to miss it. Point two of the 3 points that I've listed, obviousness. Entirely separate, entirely different path to the same result, because it's not about causation, it's about duty. The legal rule, again, I think we're all going to agree here today, there is no duty to warn about obvious risks. You said, in your opinion, in Haynes, it is, quote, usually an objective question for the court, citing Caterpillar. Now, usually is exactly correct. It's not always a question for the court, but it is usually. And the chart we gave you with 10 cases, I stopped when we got to the end of a page. We could have given you more. The Texas courts are not hesitant to call balls and strikes and to say that risk is obvious to the appropriate class. Yes, there's a judgment call. Just like a strike zone in baseball, there is a judgment call. But we know from history where you've called balls and strikes. Haynes, I think, is as good a case as we could rely on. It follows Caterpillar. And our position is that the risk was less obvious in Haynes, the invisible underground power lines, to the late Mr. Haynes, the homeowner. I think that risk is plainly less obvious than the risk we're dealing with here. Now, what about the record? I think the lawyers can help you with the record. I will call your attention to a few facts that we can synthesize to tell you something about what is obvious to this class of users, the HVAC technicians. We know from the record that the plaintiff is licensed. We know he has continuing education, like we do, as members of the legal profession. We know that to be licensed as a contractor, you need experience. Now, if you want to pull the occupations code and read chapter 1302, you can see all of the statutory requirements, but it's all borne out in the testimony from the plaintiff. And this plaintiff is at the highest level of qualifications for HVAC work. He is a licensed contractor, licensed to do commercial, licensed to do residential, in air conditioning, in refrigeration. There is no higher level, so it's sort of the equivalent of a board-certified specialist in business and consumer bankruptcy, something like that. That fact of his learning and what HVAC licensed contractors know, that was actually harnessed by the plaintiff's damage expert to pump up the lost earnings. It's totally legitimate testimony. I'm not quarreling with it, and I'm not saying the evidence of lost earnings is insufficient. But if you read Dr. Swiger, his economic expert, Dr. Swiger says, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, my numbers are conservative on volume 8, page 110. He says they're conservative because this man is a licensed contractor. He has a lot of experience. He says on page 106, I was impressed by that. So we are talking very serious experience and ongoing educational requirements that will support a determination of obviousness along the lines of what this court held in Haynes. We didn't need to go further in a defense case, but we did. During our defense case, we called an instructor. We called the department chair of Texas State Technical College, Mr. Lance Lucas, to say, give the courts and the jury a little more about what do HVAC technicians learn in class. And he went through it. It's not contradicted. He says he teaches terminal venting. You can see that. He describes more of the background. You start with electricity and certain basic principles. You can see it in the textbooks that are in evidence. So when you look at the entire record, I think you will conclude this risk is obvious to a trained, a licensed contractor. And a contractor is someone
Mr.
who
Gunn,
can take money. Yes, Your Honor.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. One of your key contentions is that the jury in this case should have been given a sophisticated user instruction, and you rely on the Humble Sand case. And I want to ask you in that case, if I recall the facts correctly, the injured person in that case was a employee of a customer who had bought a product. Why wouldn't that case be distinguishable in the case we have here in the sense that we don't have a third party? We have the HVAC unit being worked on by a repairman. We don't have a supplier-customer type situation.
I think that's a fair point, Judge. I think you're right that you get variations in the medical arena. You get the learned and intermediary problem, and it's sort of like that in Humble Sand.
Why do you think Humble Sand would still require the judge to have given that instruction that you were seeking at the trial level?
Well, we don't know for certain that it does because the Supreme Court hasn't passed on it. They said that. I guess my worry is this. When I look at the wording of the charge in that respect, I worry that there are words in there that sort of tell the jury the community, ordinary user, and I worry that that could be watered down. You're right. The court might ultimately say, no, in this context, everybody knows we're talking about a sophisticated user, and that might turn out to be correct. I just worry that we didn't get the chance to have the jury be certain about that.
And I think you know where I'm going, because my next question was going to be, in doing my preparation, I don't know nearly about much about this as you do, but I could not find a case where that humble sand instruction had been submitted to a jury. Is there one out there that I don't know about?
No, not that I know of. I don't think there is one. I looked as well. I found none. And my worry is that the standard's a little bit watered down in the pattern, and it doesn't necessarily allow for sophistication, because a jury might go back and they might say, well, you know, if it were you or me, yeah, but what about him? So, and then somebody says, well, that's not in the charge. That's the worry, but you're right, there's no case. I think it's obvious to the court that we don't believe the case should have gone to the jury, and so that's a form issue. If it goes to the jury, are we entitled to it? But to be direct, I have absolutely no prior precedent other than the statement in Humble Sand, which, as you say, is factually distinguishable.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. The third of the 3 points is the U word, unreasonably. And let's start from the axiom. Genie says it, but everybody knows it. The law doesn't guarantee a risk-free product. It does provide protection. It said you've got to have a product that is not unreasonably dangerous. So, you know, a butcher knife is dangerous, a chainsaw is dangerous. A lot of things are dangerous. The question is it too dangerous? And that is, that word unreasonably is the missing man in this case. If you look through the record, just do word search of each volume, it's almost never mentioned. Now, they'll stand up and say, well, I can point to a page where the liability expert, Dr. Russell, said yes to that question, is it unreasonably dangerous? He did. Plaintiff's counsel got to the end of direct and said, okay, I'm going to read you what turned out to be the question in the charge. It was the pattern jury question. I'm going to read you that. Are these products, are they defective under that definition? Yes, it is. It's defective. And so on. And our position on that is saying it does not make it evidence. It has to be more than just said. It has to be shown. An expert has to have a basis that is explained. And when I looked at it, in my view, that the plaintiff's expert was not using the right legal yardstick. He's using the one on page 47 of their brief. His yardstick was, a hazard-containing product is defective and unreasonably dangerous when safer alternatives exist. And if there's a hall of fame of wrongness, that statement belongs there. The fact that there's a safer alternative does not make something unreasonably dangerous. There may well be safer alternatives, but is it unreasonably dangerous? Well, we weigh things. And one of the first things we weigh is the likelihood of injury. That was never done. The plaintiff's expert didn't know it. He didn't say it. Now, I know you're facing an admissibility dispute and a sufficiency dispute. So let's just set admissibility aside for today. Let's just assume that the expert properly took the stand and that forget the gatekeeping for a second. Is it sufficient when he says that? And the answer is no. Look at the Ipsy-Dixit cases. Last Friday, there's another one. Maybe you can blame me. I lost that issue in Burrow against RC 20 years ago when my experts were blown up. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, they said it, but that's not enough. And they've been consistent time and time and time again. So their brief says, yeah, the expert said it point blank. Well, my translation of point blank is it's conclusory. It doesn't show it. The expert was opining on a different measure, a different yardstick. The briefing covers this. In my concluding moments with the court's leave, I want to point out one thing about the fire. They cannot explain how the fire leads to injury. The jury question, remember, says injury or occurrence, but injury is in all the damage questions, so they've got to be able to walk all the way through. And the plaintiff They had a fire guy. They dropped him after Garda rendered him sort of persona non grata. It's the same expert from the Garda case. And they didn't want to put him on the stand after that. So they went without a fire expert. They have a very fine electrical expert, but he can't explain the fire in a de-energized compressor. And we don't have medical testimony to say these damages, these burns came from oil only. This is a fire case. There's plenty of evidence it came from fire. There's no evidence that it came only from oil. That should cut off causation on injury. Occurrence is more complicated because it doesn't get all three of the jury findings. It only gets question one and question 2A because those are devices that deal with overcurrent protection. And the plaintiff's expert was opining about, was it overcurrent, is it arcing? That's where the fire comes in. I'll leave that to the brief. And unless the court has further questions, I yield to my friend, Mr. Levenger. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gunn.
May it please the court, Jeff Levenger for Clarence Johnson. Let me begin by addressing your question, Justice Pittman. There actually is a case that rejects the exact charge that they wanted with respect to no duty to warn people with sophistication. It's the Magro case. We cited the case elsewhere in the brief, but not for that proposition. 721 Southwest 2nd, 836, the Supreme Court upheld the trial court's rejection of a very similar instruction where they wanted the court to tell the jury that there's no duty to warn people who have special learning or expertise. The Supreme Court said that's not appropriate, and it certainly was not appropriate here. They make the point that Mr. Johnson knew about terminal venting generally, and I would say to that, it doesn't prove anything. The issue is he didn't know that this particular brand-new compressor was subject to terminal venting, and that's what makes all the difference in the world. They point to Volume 6, page 215 of his testimony, but all he said there was that he had warned his helper, Mr. Morris, in the past about terminal venting. And that actually supports his argument about causation because terminal venting was something that he took very seriously. And he said that if I'd known that this particular compressor was subject to venting, I didn't know that because they didn't warn me, in contrast to other competitors who do warn me about terminal venting. He said, I would have done something differently. I would have been very sensitive to the sounds. He said, instead of thinking that it was a kitten, I would have thought that it was a pit bull. He said, I would have been more careful, and I would have let the unit cool off before I did anything further. And that certainly establishes causation. The problem with their argument is that they're really conflating what's open and what's obvious and commonly known to HVAC designers with what's obvious and commonly known to HVAC technicians about terminal venting. Sure, HVAC technicians like Mr. Johnson, they know generally about terminal venting. What they don't know, though, is whether any particular compressor is subject to terminal venting. And here's the key. Not all compressors are equally susceptible to terminal venting. The testimony was that old reciprocating style compressors can be susceptible to terminal venting. The new scroll-style compressors, like the brand-new one at issue in this case, not so much.
Well, was there any testimony at trial that there are models that are absolutely not subject to terminal venting, or is it just a question of some are more susceptible, some are less, but they all can do it?
The testimony is basically that if you put in certain safety features, like, for example, the 700 series fuse, which was made available from FuseSight, that would significantly diminish any chance of terminal venting because it would have severed the fuse before the glass was compromised. And there were other things as well, other safer alternative designs such as the current monitoring system. There were other designs that wouldn't have eliminated the venting, but they would have prevented the user from being injured by the venting, like the permanent guard. Of course, this unit had none of this, but the problem is there's no way to tell. You can't tell by looking. Likewise, as I say, some units have safety devices, others don't, but there's no way to tell. HVAC technicians also don't know the telltale signs of terminal venting. Mr. Gunn was mentioning the HVAC trainer that they put on the stand. He admitted that even though he trains HVAC technicians, he said, I don't know the telltale signs of terminal venting, the sputtering, the popping, the crackling that presage a terminal vent. And their corporate representative, Emerson's corporate representative, admitted that they should warn He says, yeah, I guess we should warn about those telltale signs of terminal venting. Likewise, HVAC technicians, they don't know about the relationship between certain precautionary measures that can be taken, like electrical checks, and the prevention of terminal venting. And it's because of the lack of knowledge on the part of HVAC technicians about these things that competitors of Emerson, like Tecumseh and Amana, they do warn. They warn about the dangers of terminal venting, they warn about the telltale signs of terminal venting, and they warn about the relationship between certain precautions like electrical checks and terminal venting. Emerson, they don't do that. And that's why, and this is really important, that's why the absence of these warnings by Emerson creates the very misleading impression that, they have somehow succeeded in eliminating the risks of terminal venting, or they've somehow succeeded in mitigating the effects of terminal venting if it occurs. Of course, that's not true. They haven't. But the absence of warnings in the face of warnings from competitors creates this misleading impression. And there was ample testimony to that effect, volume 6, page 164, volume 7, page 32, about this misleading impression. All of that evidence establishes why there was a duty on the part of Emerson, which it breached in contrast to its competitors, to warn about terminal venting. And it also establishes, I think, how and why the absence of warnings presents an unreasonable risk of danger from this product as it was marketed. The fact of the matter is, HVAC technicians, while they know generally about terminal venting, they don't know that any particular compressor is subject to venting. And that's really the key here. And it's also the absence of that warning that's the producing cause of both the occurrence and the injury. Of course, we benefit from the presumption in Magro that that the warning, had it been given, would have been read and heeded. That's a presumption that we're entitled to get. But there's a lot more evidence than just the presumption. Mr. Johnson testified that he takes, first of all, he said, I've read these warnings in the past. I've read the Tecumseh warning, and I read the Emerson warning, and I know the difference between the two. One talks about terminal venting. The other doesn't mention it at all. He said, I take the risk of terminal venting very seriously, which is why he testified that he had told his assistant about it, not on that day, but in the past. That's the testimony of volume 6, page 215. I had told him in the past about the risk of terminal venting. He takes it seriously. And then he said, of course, he would have been alert, he would have focused on the sounds, and he would have step back and let the unit cool off. All of that establishes producing cause.
Do you concede that Dr. Russell didn't give a causation opinion on how the fire was caused?
Well, what he did, Justice Pittman, he did give testimony, which they don't really challenge now, about the causal link between the defect, that is the absence of these safety devices that would prevent or mitigate terminal venting, and the occurrence. And he testified about the link between the occurrence, the terminal event, and the injury. He did identify three possible ignition sources of the fire that happened post-vent, the post-vent fire. And he said it's electrostatic, let me get the exact word here, electrostatic discharge, mechanical sparking, and auto-ignition. He said, look, I can't tell you which one of those three for sure was the ignition source. And he wasn't required to, because that had nothing, occurred after the causal link between the defect and the occurrence and the event, which and the injury, which they don't really challenge here. But we know one thing, and that is all three of those ignition sources, which he really couldn't pin down because of the destruction to the compressor at that point in time, we know that all three of them are traceable back to the very same thing. That's the compressor and the venting materials that came out of the compressors. So he did, in fact, trace the fire origin. The origin of the fire was traced back to the very same thing, the compressor and the venting materials from that. Their own expert, volume 10, page 10, essentially admitted that the fire origin, we know where it was. It was the compressor and the venting materials. So I think it's really kind of a false issue. Moreover, Their own testimony establishes an ignition source. They said that the unit was energized, and they admit that an energized unit could provide the ignition source that would spark the fire that occurred post-vent. And the jury well could have believed that the unit was energized and made the findings that it did. That may account for why they put 10% of responsibility on Mr. Johnson. But they themselves supplied the ignition source through their own testimony, which the jury could have credited. And then finally, as I would point out, they're really, with this ignition source argument, they're really sort of trying to add an element beyond what the law requires. We proved the two necessary causal connections, defect and occurrence and injury. They're adding something else that occurred post-vent, that happened after the injury-causing terminal vent. So it's really not even relevant to the causal analysis. I want to talk briefly about design defect. I think it's telling, notwithstanding what we heard today, that they have not challenged the sufficiency of the evidence at trial that established a design defect. Instead, and that's true with respect to both the terminal, which was reflected in question one, and the compressor, which was reflected in question two. They didn't challenge the sufficiency of the evidence at all. Instead, they argue about admissibility. They say that Judge Evans somehow abused his discretion by letting our expert take the stand and testify. I would say two things about that. One is that argument was not preserved. You can read their 30-page motion to exclude. It's in the record at volume 2 of the clerk's record, page 380 to 410. You will not see anything in there making the challenge they're now making to the effect that he somehow used the wrong legal definition of design defect and somehow assumed that there's a defect simply because the product failed, that there was some accident. That's their argument now. That's not the argument they made then or at trial. In any event, the argument's just wrong, because if you read his entire affidavit, 28 pages of it, if you read his direct examination, all roughly 150 pages, to be sure he didn't use magic words, but he's not required to use magic words. And he did not somehow assume that there was a defect simply because the product failed. That's not what he did. Instead, what he said is, look, there was a problem in the motor windings inside this compressor that caused it to draw unusually high amounts of current, overcurrent, in through the terminal pins. In fact, Mr. Gebhardt, their corporate representative, admitted the same thing, that the root cause was an overcurrent. And he said that overcurrent caused the terminal pins, to heat up way past the point that they should have, to the point where they actually started melting the glass. And of course, it was the melting of the glass that caused the pins to eject and the venting materials to come out of the compressor. That's the terminal vent. And then he said, and this is significant, he said the design defect here is the failure to put in the mechanisms that would either detect the high current or the high temperature and the high current and cut it off before the glass melts, or something that would mitigate the effects of a terminal vent in the event it occurred. That's what he said, and that's absolutely the right test. He said that it's the conclusion he made, and I say conclusion because the question was put to him at the very end in kind of a summary fashion, reading the question the jury was getting, but he concluded yes. It is unreasonably dangerous because the utility of this product, sure, it has utility, but not in a manner that allows it to vent, is significantly outweighed by the risk, the great risk here of terminal venting that's caused by the absence of the safer alternative designs that he talked about. With respect to the safer alternative designs, Mr. Gunn didn't talk about it, but I think they're adequately discussed in the brief. We have four of them. We have the 700 series fuse. They contend now that, well, maybe the 600 was just as good for the copper core pins as it was for the 700. That's belied by their own marketing materials. It's belied by their own patent. And I should note here that there are really some smoking guns in this case. I think the smoking guns are the Tecumseh warning, Plaintiff's Exhibit 11 and Plaintiff's Exhibit 161-28-28, the Fusite warning. I think it's a smoking gun because it shows that Fusite itself recognized the need to warn its customers, namely Emerson, among others, about the danger of terminal venting. And then I think another smoking gun is Plaintiff's Exhibit 1, the Copeland patent, which essentially admits that there was a defect in the prior art. They use the word problem, but it's the same point, that there was a defect in the prior art, terminals and compressors, that allowed this the overcurrent to get to the point where it would heat the pins and cause the terminal vent. I think that's a very important piece of evidence, that Plaintiff's Exhibit 1. Continuing on the safer alternative designs, we have the current monitoring system, which I mentioned earlier. We have the permanent guard, which they quibble with, talking about how, oh, it may affect the utility of the product, but the jury was entitled, I think, to disbelieve that and conclude that whatever effect it might have on the product is far outweighed by the absolutely perfect method of stopping the any terminal vent from hitting somebody in the face, it'd be diverted downward. And then we have the molded plug, which is again described in the Copeland patent, Plaintiff's Exhibit 1, and in fact was not even mentioned by them in their opening brief. So yet the molded plug is yet another way of not only protecting against terminal vent, but also potentially de-electrifying the unit before somebody can even be exposed to the terminal pin. I talked briefly about the jury charge with respect to the warning, and not appropriate at all because I'll just finish my one sentence here. The language the court actually gave in terms of a ordinary user of the product is absolutely descriptive of HVAC technicians. No one argued it's the general public, so there was no harm from that instruction. Unless the court has any, yes, sir.
I'd like to ask you one more question. If the panel doesn't mind. There's a second jury charge issue that's been brought up with regard to the risk utility test.
Yes.
The appellant is asserting that Judge Evans should have given the five factors as part of the charge as well.
Right.
Have you found any case law in which that five-factor test has been given to the jury?
No, and to the contrary, in the Turner case and the Acord case, fairly old Texas Supreme Court cases, the Supreme Court held that it was not appropriate, actually, to give those factors or any combination of those factors to a jury. And in fact, the Fifth Circuit in the more recent Goodner case agreed that it's, you know, those factors are something the courts look at in reviewing the evidence. And they're not all elements, they're just factors and you don't need to satisfy all of them. But in Goodner, the court said it's just not appropriate to give those to the jury. And it's not because they tend to go beyond the definition of design defect and they start talking about things like warning and what's obvious, and even contributory negligence-related issues. So the short answer is no, there aren't any cases. And in fact, I think the law is to the contrary.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Please, the court, I'll start with Justice Kerr's question about, is there any testimony that some models are not susceptible to terminal venting? The answer is no. There is no testimony to that effect. There is no testimony about a single model of compressor anywhere in the country that has eliminated terminal venting, and there's not evidence of a single model that uses the two alternatives that they tout, the electrical monitoring system or the permanent guard. I looked, I couldn't find it anywhere. I thought I just heard the energy question sort of come out the other way from what I expected. I thought I heard an argument that, well, maybe the unit was energized. That would explain the fire. But it breaks the causal chain because the plaintiff was trying to rule out arcing and to blame overcurrent. Remember that two of the three findings are overcurrent protection concepts, and those wouldn't have made any difference if we don't have an overcurrent situation. On the preservation argument, we heard a couple of them, so let me deal with those for completeness so that you'll have a full set of positions here. I think I heard the argument that we didn't challenge sufficiency on design liability. Well, issue number 4 in our blue brief does exactly that, and we conclude that section of the brief on page 57 saying there is, quote, no evidence of design defect. It is absolutely a sufficiency challenge. It's both. Of course, you know from cases like Havner, when you have an expert who shouldn't get on the stand at all, that's one of the 4 Calvert categories of no evidence, because a rule of evidence bars consideration of what the expert said. But in addition, this is a problem of ipsy dixit conclusory testimony. Yes, the person said it, like the expert in Coastal said, that was gross negligence. And the Supreme Court said, well, you can't just say that was gross negligence, you have to explain it. So that is a sufficiency problem as well as admissibility. I wanted to serve it up to you today as sufficiency because it's something we're more accustomed to. The admissibility calculus is a little more complex. You've got Robinson factors and so on. Here, we'll just spot them for today's purpose, that Dr. Russell gets to get on the stand. But he's got to get on the stand and do some work properly rather than just say, well, I declare it defective. There was a sufficiency argument, a preservation argument also made about our motion to exclude, but the 30-page motion to exclude, volume 2 of the clerk's record at 380, it moves to exclude all opinions from Dr. Russell. And I don't accept the construct that I have to sit back and nitpick. I say it is their burden as the proponent of the testimony. Now, if I've got an expert, it's my burden, too. It's not a plaintiff defense problem. It runs both ways. They have to carry the burden. I can file a one-sentence motion to exclude an expert, and they've got to do something with it. Now, I might irritate the judge if I did that, but I can do that. Well, I think I might. I know one judge that I would irritate if I did that. But we didn't do that. We went through it in a lot of detail, and I don't think I have to demonstrate unreliability of the expert's opinion. I think it's the other way around. And finally, Judge Pittman asked about the other jury instruction. And I agree with my friend. Turner and Acord, if we were standing here in 1986, I think Turner and Acord would probably foreclose my ability to press that argument here. I'd have to say, I'll preserve it, and if need be, I'll go down the road. The argument that we're making here today is that we're a generation later, after the statutory enactment of Chapter 82, and we have the Supreme Court now saying in Tempte, the five factors are, quote, required. That's the argument. And if you say, counsel, I hear you, but we don't feel like we can put Turner and Acord into the past history heap, I totally respect that. But I need to press the argument in order to have it before you.
And I understand. And Mr. Gunn, let me tell you why that question came up. In Judge Boyd's dissent in Genie Industries, which both of you have cited, he says, when discussing the utility factors, the five factors, whether and how appellate courts should utilize the factors when reviewing a jury verdict is a relevant issue because we have held that the factors should not be included in the jury instructions, so the jury will never actually be aware of these factors when making its decision. And when I saw that, it prompted me to ask you all the questions.
Well, and you've hit the bullseye, Judge. It may be that that's an argument that just has to be taken to Austin to undo it. It's a little incongruous to say everybody in the room, all the lawyers, all the experts know what the five factors are, but the jury doesn't get them. But if that incongruity is not something that the court feels like it can solve here, then we've made the argument. And with that, I thank you very much for the time. It's a privilege to be here to argue before you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Gunn, Mr. Levenger, thank you very much for your arguments today, and also thank you for your excellent briefing in this case. It's been very, very helpful to the court. We appreciate you coming and arguing before us today, and your case is submitted.